That's awesome. You know, that really goes with what you were saying before about like the story. And I say this to people all the time when they're like, what's the deal with fishing? Because I have a lot of non-fishing friends. I'm like, I don't care if I catch a fish. I will walk along a river and there will be white noise in my ears and I will see things and my brain will stretch out and I'm not looking at a phone. And catching a fish is, luckily, it's really low on my list of priorities because I'm actually kind of a shitty fisherman. But yeah, no, the experience of it is really, really important to me, and the actual catching is not that much.
Welcome to In the Bucket, the podcast that explores the culture of spey fishing in the Pacific Northwest, a spectacular land of mountains and wild rivers where every cast has a story to tell. I'm your host, Brian Niska.
Thank you for joining us today. Once again, we have a great show planned for you. I'm speaking with a couple of insightful anglers who happen to be accomplished professional photographers. If you're a snowboarder, the names Dano Pendergrass and Darcy Baca are likely very familiar, as these two legends are behind many of the iconic images documenting the culture and progression of snowboarding over the last 30 years. While not shooting snow sports professionally anymore, both these guys still work in the outdoor industry. Today, Darcy is the principal photographer for Sims Fishing Products, and Dano, well, he works for a design company that's so innovative, he probably can't talk about it. So if you're interested in photography, fishing, or snowboarding, this is the episode for you. I'm sure that over the course of the next hour and a half, we'll be able to help you improve your fishing photography. So let's get going. It's time to get In the Bucket with Dano Pendergrass and Darcy Baca.
Right on. Hey, thanks for joining us today. I am sitting here with my good friends, Dano Pendergrass and Darcy Baca. Dano, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
I'm a BC boy. I'm on the north side of 50. I grew up skiing and sailing in BC, and then I kind of made a name for myself in the 90s as a snowboard photographer.
Right on. How about yourself, Darcy?
Yeah, my name's Darcy Baca. I am originally from Philadelphia, and the last 18 years I've called Oregon home. I live right on the base of Mount Hood. And like Dano, I shot lots of snowboarding over the course of 10 years, maybe 12. And I've kind of transitioned more into a fishing photographer as of late.
Right on. And, you know, for myself, I grew up as a skier and I grew up as a fisherman. And I've always felt that the two activities really related to each other. You know, what's going on in the mountains definitely affects what we see in the river. And within the bucket, there seems to be this common theme. A lot of people who are into snow sports, a lot of people who are up on the mountains, but also enjoy their time in the valley. I've been really looking forward to speaking with you guys because, you know, as professional photographers, regardless of whether you're shooting fishing or shooting snowboarding, you know, you're engaged in your passion, but you're not perhaps the guy getting to have all the fun. How has that been for you guys being on that side of the lens, both in the mountains and on the river?
I think it's an interesting point because at a very early age, I kind of turned a bunch of passions into jobs. And for me, it was a really conscious decision to not become a fishing photographer or a fishing guide because I wanted to leave it as the passion and not make it into work. Because like you said, once you're in work mode around the thing you love, it stops being the thing you love in the same way.
I respect that so much, Dano, honestly. and man, it kind of sucks that I had fly fishing, which has been like my passion, my life while I was a snowboarding photographer. I was literally like shooting Wendells and stuff. And like Tim Wendell, he would be like, he knew I would just go fishing all the time. And like, I'd be clocked in, I'd have interns doing my job and he loved it. He was like, dude, do what you're passionate about. And now that I've transitioned out of shooting snowboarding because the industry kind of collapsed for me personally, I've gone full head, like right into the fishing deal. And I mean, there's no looking back. I'm kind of in it now. So I'm looking for other passions in life. Not to say that fly fishing and fishing won't be passions, but it's definitely like, man, there's so many times where I'm just like sitting there watching fishing now. Like we were in the backcountry shooting snowboarding and you're just like, wow. And you know what? You know what's become bigger passion in my life now is snowboarding.
Which is great.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like last year, Andy Wright and myself, like we're like best buds snowboarding now, which is like crazy because he was like my biggest idol obviously as a snowboarding photographer growing up. And now he's like hitting me up like this morning. He's like, dude, are you up there? Like, where are you at? And I'm like, well, I'm doing a fishing podcast because we just got this blizzard, but I'm grateful to be here. And he told me that it was wind packed up there. So
I'll tell you the other side of that story though, is that, you know, you get to a certain point in your life and all the other things you decided to make your career become so busy that then you start to lose your ability to fish and snowboard. And that's, you know, it's always a trade-off and a balance, and it's hard to keep that balance in balance.
Yeah, absolutely.
Given the choice, I'd rather be going, you know, tarpon fishing than going to an office.
Well, it's a fine line. And it's funny because, like, as much as I feel like shooting photos for Sims and stuff has like kind of made photography, like fishing photography, work, it's also opened up so many different doors in fishing. So now I'm like, I would have never had the opportunity to go and like experience like tarpon fishing and bone fishing. And I'm going to the Bahamas next week. You know what I mean? So, and that's where I think my fishing is like steelhead fishing has been taking a bit of a backseat, because I'm just like, wow, here's this whole avenue of fishing that I'm not good at. So it's like more of a drive to try to get better at it. And like, for me, like that's what kind of creates passions, is starting out really shitty at something and wanting to get better. And so for me, that's tarpon fishing and saltwater fishing.
This is the interesting kind of thing about the relationship between fishing and photography though. And it's that, you know, if you're become really good and maybe a little bit bored with one aspect of either one, there's so many different doors you can open and go down. Like, okay, so I've been shooting action sports, blah, blah, blah. Maybe I'll start shooting large format portraits or blah, blah, blah. Change your, you know, the subject matter, or change the equipment. It's the same with fishing. You know, it's like, I've been fishing nothing but chronomids for 3 seasons. Well, then you're just insane. But, you know, you can go to the river, and, you know, there's always a new kind of thing to unlock there.
100%. I think that's why we get addicted to it all, because there's always like another door to open when one starts to like get kind of stale, you know what I mean?
Yeah, certainly.
So here's a question I've always wondered. So I've never really been much of a professional photographer or anything like that, though I did get a magazine cover once. I was very proud of that. Thank you, Lightroom. But I always wondered, when you're up in the mountains and it's, you know, right now it's minus 30 up there, how hard is it to keep your gear working? And then the follow-up to that, Darcy, is, okay, now you're in the Bahamas and it's plus 30. How hard is it to keep your gear working? And what sort of tricks of the trade could you share with our listeners for keeping their gear performing the way they want it in those type of extreme environments?
Yeah, well, I always, if I know I'm going to be working in like wet, cold, or just wet in general, a lot of times I'll keep things in plastic baggies, like in my backpack. Especially with snowboarding, I remember like in Revelstoke, like we'd always have, it snows every day. So you're like, every time you open up your camera bag to get something, snow's getting in your backpack. So there's lenses that you might only be using for a little bit during the day. And I'll have bags, like Ziploc bags, and I'll literally just take them in and out of that. And it just helps a little bit. It's kind of inevitable. But as far as like cold and hot goes, I feel like my camera equipment hasn't really struggled with that. The biggest thing is just moisture. And it's just trying your best to keep it dry, bringing it inside at night and letting everything dry out, and just being on it, especially on like prolonged trips where you're like in and out of rain all day.
I think that people don't realize that when you're changing temperatures dramatically too, that condensation becomes a really big issue. And so, you know, when you're going from cold and outside and dry, and then you go inside and you think, oh, everything's dry, it was cold, but you'll get fog spots in your lenses. So like the transition, a slow transition from cold to warm is important. And, you know, we work in places that are, you know, the least conducive to machinery, like salt, sand, cold, and water. Like, yeah. This is stuff electronics hates.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful.
The other thing that I do is I'll take these industrial silicone packets, like kind of like the big ones that come in your clothes when you get them, or in like a cardboard box, but they make them that are like 6 inches by 6 inches, like 20 centimeters by 20 centimeters, you know. And I just throw a bunch of them in all my bags. And so they're always just trying to pull moisture. And that's one thing that seems to help. I'd like to think it does, because I just load my backpacks and Pelican cases up with that stuff. So
you'd be surprised how much moisture can get into a camera bag just over the course of a day. It takes a long time to dry those things out.
It really does. It's funny. I've like had issues with getting too much snow and water and stuff on cameras from like shooting, snowboarding, and I've definitely like lost cell phones and whatnot due to fly fishing and whatnot. But the only time I've actually totaled a camera because of water was on a G-Shock watch. And I put my camera on, like, I was like taking pictures of these watches, like product shots next to a pool. And I put my camera on a table right next to the pool, and the whole thing just went in the water. 7200, Z9. Insurance covered everything. And oh, that's another thing. Insure your stuff. I go through a PPA, Professional Photographers of America. I don't know if Canadians are allowed to do that, but probably. But yeah, basically, just by having the membership, you get like $15,000 worth of insurance. And since I had that whole deal with my camera going in the water, I've like leveled up the insurance to like cover everything. So it's like, I get like all my camera equipment. I could literally, they say that somebody could come, maybe I shouldn't be telling everybody this, but yeah, out of an unlocked car, somebody could take all my camera equipment. No questions asked. They replace everything. So yeah, getting good insurance is huge. And it's like not all that expensive, really.
It's cost of doing business if that's your living. I mean, everybody in every industry has an insurance for something, you know? Those are the tools.
Still love them to death, but Filmer for Sims, I cannot convince him to get insurance. I don't know what is going on with him. he sees what I had to go through, like this whole traumatic experience. Like, is insurance going to cover this water damage? Sure enough, they did, but yeah, he still doesn't have it. I don't know how to convince him otherwise. Maybe he'll listen to this podcast.
Well, some people do the dollar cost average, right? They work out how much the insurance is going to cost over time.
Right.
And then they look at replacement cost of an entire rig and they think, is that worth it? And it can be if you get extremely lucky. But the truth is that, you know, if you have two claims in 2 years, the whole bet is off. You're screwed. So.
And like the stuff that we do is way more accident prone than like some like school portrait photographer, you know what I mean?
Right.
Like I literally take my, also hopefully insurance company never hears this, I take my camera and just like hover it over the water and like depths unknown to me. Just try to get that like low down sort of close to the water perspective. So yeah.
So Darcy, you're working a lot with Sims these days, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much their primary photographer. They hire out a couple other photographers for various things. I think I'm the only one with a retainer with them. And then Rex Messing, who hires me, he also shoots photos. So he'll be shooting a lot of photos during our photo shoots as well. But I'm the primary camera body.
So for a lot of people listening, I mean, you guys have the cheat codes here in the sense that you've managed now multiple times to take a passion, an activity people look forward to, and essentially turn it into a job and become the guy for Sims taking photos. Obviously, you know, you have a skill set they were interested in. Is it something from snowboarding that you were able to apply to fishing? Because obviously, you know, there's a lot of fishing photos out before you started taking them. What is it about your work that made Sims want to work with you, do you think?
Well, I think the biggest thing was, it was actually, I think I had a kind of a pivoting point with my photography during, it was a pro photo showdown up in Whistler, where it like kind of made me pick out all the photos that started telling more of a story instead of just the photos that were just a really cool photo to look at. And because like I did that event up in Whistler, I started steering all my photography to not focus 100% on like the crazy action sequences, but to really try to document everything that was going on. And I think I kind of just started doing that for fun, like going up to like Terrace and Smithers area and hanging out with like Eric Jackson. I would always have my camera with me and I would just be taking pictures of us up there fishing. Didn't necessarily have fish photos in it or anything, but it was just like this storytelling aspect of us up there. And I started sharing my photos from those trips with Sims, and they ended up a couple years in a row, they started buying the whole stack off of me. And I was like, whoa, this is cool. Okay, well, maybe this will turn into something. And then they started hiring me out for different photo shoots, a lot of them being like bass fishing and ice fishing and musky fishing and stuff, like things that I didn't really know about at all. But like I learned how to tell those stories. And like with shooting the fishing photos, it's like, especially for Sims, it's such, if we go to a whole photo shoot and don't get a fish the whole time, like we still have a successful shoot because there's so much aspects to fishing that are photographic. And that's kind of how I got my start with Sims, I suppose.
And Dan, your story is really, really unique because, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were there for the golden era of snowboarding when things really got going, weren't you?
This is how old I am. I did the second ever pro photo showdown in Whistler, and it was slides and carousels.
Oh, that's so cool.
Also, it was my first ever slideshow in front of about 500 people.
Yeah.
And I'd never done one before. There wasn't time to do a dry run. So my carousels were stacked wrong. So my first and second half of the show just kind of blended together. I had them set up chronologically so it would be one tray then the other, but that's not how trays work. So my show is completely like intermixed back end and first end. And it didn't sync with the music anymore. And the timing went wrong. So I ended up just saying to the audience, so do you guys want to see some more photos? And everyone cheered. And then I like showed the rest of my show while I just spoke about them, and then got extremely drunk that night. Over the course of the night, I had every judge come up to me and say, man, you really blew it, but your photos might have won. And that was, you know, that was super encouraging.
Yeah, totally. That's rad. Were you just there like on a button, just like hit like scrolling, try to scroll through it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Literally on a button.
That is so fun.
In my mind, I'd done the dry run with like the thing syncing up. So you lose sense of the sync as like right off the bat, you lose it. So yeah, it was a trip. And there was actually some fishing stuff in that too, but primarily snowboarding for sure. Snowboarding didn't start until 1987, 88 in Whistler, and I was here for that. So I've been around for a long time.
Yeah, you know Bud Fawcett then?
Not super well, but we've met a few times and he's certainly my hero.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, we do this professional photography workshop, Wendell's. It's called something different now.
Yeah, like Zimmerman's done it before too, right?
Yeah, Zimmerman's still doing it. It's basically me and Andy.
Yeah.
And we usually get like 12 students up there and like it's a whole snowboarding photography workshop. It's awesome. But Bud comes in the first night and he shares all of his photography. He has a slideshow that he shares with all his students. And it's really cool like because he always switches it up every year a little bit for us because he's got so many insane photos. Like, it's crazy. That guy is a legend.
For listeners who don't know who Bud is, he started shooting snowboarding in an era where the equipment wasn't really very good before mainstream had taken a look. And he shot the Tahoe scene that was kind of the birth of freestyle snowboarding. So he got pictures of just legendary snowboarders that were outperforming anybody in the world at that time. And he has a kind of a photojournalistic eye as well as an action sports eye. So there's all kinds of like behind the scenes stuff that's really cool. You know, that real storytelling stuff when you were talking about shooting with Sims and how you don't need to catch a fish to tell a story. I mean, I think that's the aspect of photography that a lot of us gravitate to eventually is that the story behind, you know, and that can be with anything. I just got a book called Mars Guitars about Johnny Mars guitars, and the photography is just incredible. Just details of guitars. You can't imagine that there'd be so much character and story just from a picture of a guitar, you know?
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter subject matter. When you're a good photographer, you can tell a story anywhere.
Yeah, got a lot of respect for Bud. He also had a traumatic accident, and if there's other snowboarding photographers listening to this, it was like one of the accident involved a snowboarder landing on him, and his arm's been basically paralyzed ever since. So be careful where you're standing, because Bud's like the primary example of just having a traumatic experience change your whole life. So, but yeah.
Have you ever been hit?
I have been real close. Jonah Owen almost landed on me once to the point where like it slapped so hard about 2 feet away from my leg that if he had landed on my leg, it would have been shattered for sure.
Damn.
And so we tell all of our students that too. Like, we're like, well, see where, but like, and especially like shooting up at Mount Hood during the summer, it's such a shit show up there that people are just coming at you from all angles. And it's like, hey, the biggest part is like, let's just make sure we get nice photos, but we also get off the hill without hurting somebody or getting hurt ourselves. It's easy. Like, so many people are just hanging out on like the knuckles of jumps and stuff. Like, having that constant communication with who you're shooting is obviously really important. So that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I got a flat base from Freddie Culbermatten right into a 20 mil one time and broke my nose, but that's the worst I had it.
Yeah. And you can imagine, like, you're like, you probably think back at that. You're like, well, if I was standing a little bit different or like blah, 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 like.
And it's that, you know, it was a pipe shoot. So I'd had shot that angle enough times to go like, oh, he's going to land there. I'm going to be here. But he came out and that happens, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Well, we have kind of Eric Jackson in common. I started shooting with him in the early 2000s. And then I don't think we ever did Terrace together, but did a lot of backcountry stuff together. And then as he got better and better, or got more and more well-known, you started to shoot with him a lot. And you guys did all of that Terra stuff that was just so FOMO making.
Dude, big shout out to Skeenis Bay for hosting us up there, obviously. Thank you, Brian. But yeah, that was like one of the, man, I'll tell you what, like 2018 was a hell of a year. We had like the best run of steelhead up there. We had alignment, and then we got thrown into COVID right after it. But we had a really good little deal going into COVID, that's for sure, because that whole alignment piece that we did up there was really special.
Yeah, we loved having you guys. That was something. And I was telling Curtis the other day when I was speaking with him, and I think Eric's aware too, I've met two families now, both of them instantly from Quebec, who moved to Terrace after watching Alignment. So no joke,
wow.
That movie changed these folks' lives. And one family in particular, the kids, I fished with them this summer, last name Sims, it's interesting enough, the Sims brothers. These kids are little rippers, man, and they're great on their bikes. They're, you know, they were fun to fish with, quick study on the fly casting, but you should see the snowboard clips they're putting together, and their parents are really supporting this, you know, this for them. And it's amazing to see the progression. And honestly, for our area, our little community owned ski hill operating as a co-op, Shames Mountain, 40 feet of snow a year, only open 4 days a week. these kids, this is the best organic advertising, I'll call it a resort, but a small ski area could have, is the people who are out there using the terrain, telling their stories. So here's the tie-in. These kids are being filmed by their parents. They're doing a great job. I recognize you guys shoot stills. You don't film necessarily. But what do you think of the tech these days? I mean, Dano, you're just old enough to have seen it all basically come through, haven't you? Whereas now, you know, I got this phone and I can take incredible pictures and videos with it. And you've got a backpack full of expensive gear. How's that been?
It's interesting because they're in the film era. I remember I was shooting a jump, really famous jump in the Whistler backcountry called Perfect Jump. And the angles on it are super limited. There's not a lot of places that you can shoot it. And I had shot, I mean, we pioneered that jump. We weren't the first, but we shot it the most. And so I'd shot it every single way. There was just no other way. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know, if I could just be like 40 feet higher and off to the left, I'd be get the exact angle I want. And it just seemed like such a pipe dream. And then I was like, you know, if I could just shoot 10 frames a second, that I would be able to get. And now all that stuff's in your pocket. You know, like every DJI drone and every iPhone is better than my camera in 1998.
That's crazy. I'll tell you what, the one thing that does make me nervous for the future, and I've been doing photos for like product environmental portraits and stuff for Coast Portland. They do headlamps and flashlights and knives and stuff. And they've been starting to share examples of how they want their photos to look through AI.
Wow.
And the AI is so close to exactly what they need. I'm like, man, like this is one of my biggest clients. Like as soon as they figure out how to just put their headlamp on the AI model, like I'm out of the job. And like, I was blown away when I started seeing the examples that they're giving me. They're like, we want this so-and-so person wearing this in this environment and wearing a headlamp. like in a beanie, and it would literally, like, they would show it to me, and I'd be like, that's AI? Like, it looks like an actual person. But luckily, it's only a little light on the head. It's not like the actual Coast Light. So I'm like, I still got a little bit of time. But yeah, it's I can see the future with, like, AI. Like, they'd be able to, I mean, I don't think Sims would ever do this because there's so much more, like I said, storytelling to what they want shot. But you could just have, like, a model, like, in the studio wearing the jacket, so you have the images of it, and then incorporate that into an AI model, and then boom, any environment you want. It's crazy.
I think if you're a studio photographer, certainly that's going to be a huge threat.
Yeah.
I think people will continue to seek out real stories, though, in the real world with real people, and that kind of, like, that documentary approach. You can make up a story, but fiction's different than documentary, you know, and people, a true story always strikes you differently than a fictitious story. And I don't think, you know, there's been, when CGI came along, it did a lot to damage product photography because it's so good. You know, if you see, we just finished doing a CGI shoe, and it's, you know, I'm also shooting it in the studio at the same time as we did the CGI. And I'm just like, why are we doing this in this studio? But the thing that you can't do in the CGI is, like, the hand doing the gesture of whatever that's really human. And we have a really good kind of bullshit detector to be able to see when that's not real. And so, you know, it's the first thing. And obviously we're going to progress past this really quickly with AI, but it had a really hard time with eyes and hands. You know, the initial images, it was really tough to get round pupils and the eyes that looked the same and all that, which will, I mean, that's early stage stuff. But I think that it's not so much the technology as the consumers. The consumers will demand true stories.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it's just like you were saying, like with true stories, it's like real people. Like, people want to relate to people. And if it's somebody that you can't relate to because it's some AI-generated deal, like there's obviously going to be that purpose where there's that studio sort of aspect where people don't care. But, like, a lot of people are going to be like, we want to see Eric Jackson. We want to see his face.
That's right.
And yeah, that's where I think we're still safe with our jobs for a little bit longer.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, you can draw a picture of somebody on an Alaskan peak, but it's not the same as seeing Johan going down Alaskan peak.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like it just, okay, it's a big mountain, whatever. But then when you put somebody on that mountain and watch them going 100 miles an hour, your heart races. So what's different there? You know, the difference is it's truth, and truth matters. And there's nothing more true than scaring the shit out of yourself.
So here's a question for you guys. Thinking fishing, you know, you both love to fish. You're just out fishing with a buddy. Are you packing a camera, or do you have your phone, or do you don't care at all?
I usually just have my phone.
Yeah, I would never take a camera out. If I was going for fun, I'd never take a camera back.
Yeah, I usually try to, I've been trying to save my moments, like going out with, like, my girlfriend or, like, just with some friends. Like, I leave everything at home. I have my phone. And that's kind of what takes me off the clock of work. And, like, I will sometimes, like, it kind of is situational, but a lot of times I'll just be like, I have more room for camping gear if I don't bring my camera equipment. So
if I'm fishing alone, though, it's a different story. Sometimes I'll take, you know, because being by yourself and on your own schedule, sometimes the most important thing that can happen to you is seeing an amazing scene and taking a picture of it. As a photographer, that's as good as catching a big fish. It's like, this is a thing that I'll never see again. And if I don't have a camera and that happens, then I'm like, ah, I blew it. I've got an iPhone, but not the same.
That happens way more often than I'd like to admit. Where you're just like, oh man, my fun day just turned into the most epic, beautiful thing. And all I have is, like, my over dynamic range phone and, like, overly sharp.
I'm like, what are they doing with that contrast and sharpness? It's insane.
Oh, it is. I could tell my camera to do that when I wanted it to.
Yeah.
But no, it's pretty wild. But with that said, there is moments where I wish I just had, like, a really small, I like being able to shoot a photo as good as I possibly can. And so if I can't do that, like, I don't want camera equipment. Like, as soon as I take my phone out, I just literally lift it up and take a picture. Like, I don't put anything behind it because I know it's not going to be my best self behind the lens. And so if I had something that's really small, and it might be an investment in the future that I could just, like, put in a little dry bag or, like, and just always have like a really nice camera, whether it's just fixed lens and basically a point and shoot, that I would be able to shoot images. I think Sony makes something that could actually fall in that realm. But yeah, just something that I can keep in like my little hip bag or something.
I think the perspective that I've been getting on some of my early photography, because now I'm looking back over 30 years. And when I started, I was really focused on action. I didn't shoot the story very much. I just shot the tricks. My whole like mantra was, I'm shooting progressive freestyle on natural terrain. That's all I care about. And so I wouldn't shoot even a headshot of the people. I would just be shooting the tricks. And I really felt like I was documenting the progression of the sport, which was true. But I look back and the photos that I gravitate to, a lot of them are from little point and shoot camera that I carried, because they're standing around shots and the loading the sleds and the, you know, all of the thing, the travel shots. And it doesn't take a really high resolution digital sensor to make that happen. You can literally get a $100 film point and shoot and take those photos. And that's kind of the great thing about film, is that it's not a race to resolution. It's about the character of the image. And so, you know, that I used to shoot a Yashica T4 all the time. And that was just a really great little put it in your pocket camera, but it also had a great lens in it. And, you know, and black and white film. Black and white film is timeless. It can be a little bit out of focus. It doesn't matter. It looks great, you know, but it's still better than an iPhone photo. And I don't want to disparage iPhone, because like it is documented my recent life for sure. But there's something about it that it's trying too hard to make professional photos almost. And the character of an image that sticks with you is that weird device at the time. I'm starting to like early stage 2 megapixel photos that I took, because they have now a character, you know, although those cameras were terrible. But but yeah, I mean, something small in your pocket that's not a phone, it's just one more thing. But at some point, that may be the right thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that might be the next purchase I get. It's just something that I can, just a fun little documentary style camera that I could just bring, like always have with me. I think that's important, because I think that's where I run into a roadblock sometimes. Just I have so much gear. Like when I go on a photo shoot, I'm like, well, I need this, especially with Sims. Like I'm packing for the Bahamas right now. I'm like, I've got like 2 Pelican cases. I've got my camera backpack. I literally have everything that it could possibly need, except for a little camera that I could always have on me.
But that's the one thing that happened with iPhone, is that we just kind of, we gave up with that piece, because it's like, oh, I got this.
Yeah.
But it's not the same. You know, you actually consider, when you pull out a camera that's, you know, for a certain thing, you consider your photos more. And that's, you know, when we were talking before the show about like something that you can do to make your photos better, like the thing you can do to make your photos better is think about them. You know, think about the picture you're taking, because we don't. We just go click and that's it.
Yeah, that's what my iPhone's done to me. It's made me a bad photographer.
It's true.
And I'm like, whoa, that looks pretty cool. Like that's looks way better than what I'm looking at right now.
So Instagram's really perhaps negatively affected things a lot, hasn't it? Its influence in fishing is you can't argue how it's affected fishing. But here's a question for you guys that is something I personally struggle with, and I suspect a lot of people do. So everyone's out there snapping photos, documenting their life. All this stuff goes up to a cloud somewhere, essentially probably never a lot of it to be reviewed again. As a professional, Darcy, how do you stay organized with all the images that you're taking?
Well, I am an anomaly, because everybody else uses Lightroom. I use Photoshop and Bridge.
Me too.
Oh, hell yeah. Wow. I didn't think I'd ever meet another.
Yep. And you're a Nikon shooter too.
And a Nikon shooter.
Dude, what the hell?
We got so much fun. But yeah, I just have like I'm like so visual. I like being able to see where everything's going. I've got a very simple way that I just organize like all my folders. It'll go by year, and then you'll open that up and it'll be like another set of folders. It's like invoice, receipts, photography, clients, like stuff like that. And it just works for me. But I think the biggest thing is just coming up with a system that works for you and sticking with it. And so now I do this, the photography workshop with Andy and Zimmerman, and they've got a completely different way to do it. And they're like, are you ever going to try it like how we're doing it? And I'm like, I don't think so. Like, why would I fix something that's not broken? Like, this is working really well for me. And they're like, you got us there. Like, you're literally like, nothing is wrong with what you're doing. You're just doing it different. So I think being consistent with your photo management and just like coming up with a organization system that works for you. For me, it's just like breaking it down by year. And then in those folders, I'll go like little keywords and dates and stuff. And it, yeah, what I, if I could show you, I would show you, but for, it works really well for me.
I use probably the same naming convention as Zimmerman and probably the same one as Andy, because when I was a photo editor at a snowboarding magazine and did a photo summit in Whistler and brought Zimmerman up to teach it, and his whole naming convention thing, I think everybody there still uses, and he got it from D65 or whatever. But that system really works with how computers organize files, so you can sort it really easily, and it's date-based and keyword-based. I struggle a little bit more with the keywords because my system seems to kick them out sometimes, but the naming convention is really important. And I've brought that over to almost everything I do now. My invoicing and receipts and everything is all based on the same convention.
Yeah, same here. But yeah, Zimmerman's a wizard.
Wizard.
Like, it's crazy. So he's taught some classes up there in Whistler. Is that what you're saying?
I did like a photographer summit where we all got together and just sort of had meals and talked turkey, and did a bunch of seminars, and he did the file seminar, and it was early days, like 2006 early days, and everyone was trying to understand how to deal with this new onslaught of files that they had to deal with. And so that system that he taught has, I still use it for everything today.
You ought to come down to the photo workshop on Mount Hood.
I'd
hang out for a couple of days.
I absolutely would. I've never been invited.
Oh man. Hear this formal invitation. You're invited.
I would love
to. You got to come down. It's, and I learn something new from Zimmerman every year because he just is just nerding out on that, and he brings something new every year that I'm like, whoa, that's a really cool technique to edit some more. Like, I had no idea you could do that.
It's an interesting thing with editing. It's like there's a constant the gains from what Adobe's doing, and they're making things better all the time. So there are files that in 2006 I thought were gone forever and useless. And then over time, Adobe has gotten so good at editing things that I've saved files or I've revisited things that I thought were gone. And you can't sleep on that technology. It's really evolving all the time. But yeah, that Zimmerman has always been a wizard.
So here's a question for you guys. You know, as a lot of people listening might know, I spent over a decade in Whistler, 12 years, if I remember correctly, and had a fly fishing school in a little shop there specializing in spey fishing. And obviously, Whistler's a ski town, snowboard town to you guys. I noticed a huge number of people who were, as I said at the start of our show, who were interested in skiing and snowboarding, who wanted to take up fly fishing. And you guys, you know a ton of snowboard pros. I bet you, between the two of you, you probably know everyone there is. Is this something that's always been that way, or is this a trend? Is this something that's developing over time where these snow athletes are interested in fishing as they get older?
Well, I just think that, like, especially in a place like Whistler and like where I live and up in Terrace too, there's always a lot of downtime between being able to go up and shoot and snowboard. And especially if you're like traveling and making your way through like the Whistler area, you're either going out and partying up there and you're making good use out of your time and like going and exploring the river. And because there's so, you can't go up and shoot and snowboard every day there. Like, it's not, it's a lot of times it's not even worth it, but you want to be ready for those days that are going to be really good. And yeah, I think for a lot of us, like when we go and we're traveling to the Pacific Northwest and Whistler and Terrace, is like having like that other thing to be able to go out and do while you're waiting for the weather, because a lot of times when the weather's not great for snowboarding, it's really good for fishing and vice versa.
For me, it started out as just an off-season thing. So, I mean, I started out, the season would end and I could kind of beat the freshet and get into the rivers a little bit, and then they would blow out and I'd be on the glacier, but the glacier, you can only shoot so much. And then the Southern Hemisphere wouldn't start cranking until later, and there was a period in there. And I literally would have a month at a time where I was like, now what am I going to do? And mountain biking kind of took that up for a lot of people, but for some of us, it was just fishing, you know? So I spent more days on the Birkenhead River than anybody for years. And I basically was getting paid for a snowboard life, but living a fish life, you know? And the economics of things changed. It's not as free as it was then. It was less expensive to live, and I was getting paid pretty well, and the demands of the clients weren't as high. And so there was a lot of time, and there was a full wallet and a full fridge, and it was easy.
Yeah. When I was, before I started working with Sims and getting all these jobs for Coast Portland, I was basically just shooting snowboarding, and I wasn't making a whole lot of money doing it. I was like right on the cusp of being too late to the party, but, I would be making just enough, and then I would be having all fall to kind of be able to do whatever I want with. So like that freedom was huge for me. And so that's when I started. Me and Eric, we actually met in Pemberton, and we kind of were like the first evening that we met each other, we're like, dude, I've been like really thinking about going up and like trying to figure out steelhead fishing up on the Skeena and like its tributaries. And we're like, we just got to go up there and do it. And so like literally our second time meeting ever was I picked him up in Bellingham with my Subaru and a little trailer, my snowmobile trailer, because I was just towing my my snowmobile with the Subaru at the time. And so I dumped the snowmobile off of it, and just like put coolers and all the camping gear. I had a little Honda Ruckus that I put on there, and I was like, we can run our own shuttles. Like I had two Watermasters, and we just went up there, and like he was only able to hang out for a couple weeks. I think I stayed up there for like 6 weeks, and for like probably 5 or 6 years after that first time, like me and Eric just made it a point every fall to just drop everything we had going on, which wasn't a lot because we were dirtbag snowboarders and fly fishermen, and that was our time of year that we could do whatever we wanted with. And I would just go up, and Brian would always like have a place for us to stay and like take showers if we needed to. And yeah, and but for the most part, we were just like living off the grid, and yeah, it was really cool. And now it's funny because now that I'm working for a fishing company, turns out I'm working off all. So yeah, and that's kind of what's I think brought me to like try getting super into duck hunting. Like I never really thought of myself like going down that sort of rabbit hole myself, but like I recently was just looking for more activities to do, and like this, and now my window of freedom is kind of very late, like fall, early winter, and into January, where I don't have a whole lot going on. And I'm like, well, here's a whole thing I can get obsessed with that. And it's been duck hunting, and I'm horrible at it. I'm not good at it at all. But like, I think that's why it's so fun for me, because it's so much more, it's like a lot to learn. And it's a lot that I know that there's a very limited amount of time every year you can do it. So I'm like, well, maybe this passion is going to last for a little while, or for a really long time. That is just because I think that it's going to stay fresh for a while. And it's like that and like tarpon fishing, like it's such an unobtainable thing for me that I can only do it a couple times a year. So I'm like, I can see myself being obsessed with this for the rest of my life. And like, and with that said, like what I was saying earlier, like steelhead fishing, I love it so much. I did it and I'm still doing it, but I did it so like gung-ho for many, many years. And now my girlfriend's the one that's like, hey, can we go fishing? I really just want to go fishing. I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, we can go. And like, we went out the other day and I'm like fishing behind her. And I brought her up to this Skeena this year. And like, God, she caught like two steelhead behind me, actually. I finally caught one behind her. And I was like, haha, finally got one behind you. But yeah, she's like frothing on it. And like seeing that excitement out of her gets me really excited about steelhead fishing again, because I feel like it's one of those things, like once I get in the river and I start doing it, I'm like right back to like, I just want to do this all day. I don't want to get out of the water. But yeah, I think for me, steelhead fishing, it's been such a huge part of my life. Like I can kind of take it easy with it, and like I can do it when it's dictated and not like force it upon myself. But I feel like when I was going up and basically living in a tent up in Smithers and Terrace area, like it was like all my life. And now I've got all these other activities that I like to go and do, which I think is really important.
There's a parallel here, isn't there? From, you know, someone moving to a ski town for the first time and they're not going to miss a day. They're up there riding every single day. And then you get to a point where you just kind of know enough to pick your days. And perhaps there's a similarity with steelhead fishing, watching the weather, understanding the freezing level, making sure you're there at the right place at the right time.
Totally.
And I got to ask you, I was curious about the duck hunting. I've never done it, Darcy, but when I think of duck hunting, I just think of being absolutely soaked and frozen cold. Is this on brand?
Yeah, it's literally steelhead fishing, but trying to shoot a duck instead. Yeah. And like yesterday, I'm like, I got my older waders that I was like, oh man, I'm not too worried. Like they're old Sims boot fit waders and I've been using them during the duck season. And I must have like torn them in the crotch, like going over some barbed wire fence or something. Cause I went out to put out my decoys yesterday and I've just been doing it by myself. I literally don't know what I'm doing. I'm just like going out there. I'm like trying to make bird noises and get them to come closer to me. But I'm putting out all my decoys and I'm like, my waders are just filling with water. I'm like, oh boy, this is going to be a whole thing. And like the blind that I'm sitting in is literally waist deep in water. I'm like I'm sitting down. And like by the end of the day, not only is it like a blizzard out, but like there is water that's filled all the way up to my waist in my waders. Instead of like trying to lay on my back in like the mud and get all the water out, I'm just like, I'm just going to walk all the way back to the truck and like the 10 gallons of water that are in my waders. And I'm like, this is steelhead fishing, but like a whole different, totally different new thing for me. So I'm like, yeah, we just are gluttons for punishment in the waterfowl and steelhead fishing worlds.
It's an interesting thing though, that, you know, Brian, you make a point that, you know, when you get good enough at something that you can pick your days and, you know, fish smarter or hunt smarter or, you know, and not spend those little wrong days out there. But when I look back at my experiences, I think that many of my favorite ones are the days when I just didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was there on the wrong day and something amazing happened, or maybe there weren't supposed to be fish that day and there were, and then you've learned something that nobody else knows. So like that picking the days is, there's something to be said for being the keener who's out there all the time. That's how you really grind out that knowledge, you know?
Yep.
And it stinks when you become a weekend warrior, let me tell you.
Dano, I know you've been back and forth. You spent a tremendous amount of time in Whistler, and then you also did a stint in the city, like right downtown. Where's home today?
Whistler, back in black. I moved back up almost 2 years ago now. I'm working in Squamish. And so I commute 3 days a week and work from home 2 days a week. And I am a weekend warrior. So that's one of the crazy things is now I have all these passions and I have to figure out how I can fit them into 2 days a week. It's difficult. And actually it's an argument for fishing because there are fewer people on the river than there are on the mountain. And knowledge on the river takes you a lot further than knowledge on the mountain these days because everybody knows everything up there.
How many years were you out of Whistler for?
Oh, a lot. I left in 2005 and moved to California to be a photo editor of a snowboard magazine, and then moved back to Vancouver in like 2008. And then I was just back up here 2 years ago. So I was gone for not a decade, but almost.
I got to ask, you know, so I left Whistler in 2012, I think. And, you know, a question I often ask people, I remember asking Feet this in particular, you know, when was peak Whistler? And you get some different answers.
Right.
And for some people, peak Whistler's right now.
I think that's for very few people.
But that's my question to you is, you know, obviously the place has changed in your time frame. And we've heard a lot about the bad, you know, huge lift lines, expensive prices. What's the good, Dan? What's better today in Whistler than was 20 years ago, say?
Long pause. What is better? I would say restaurants, but not really. There were great restaurants back then as well. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that anything's better right now. Honestly, it was a better time when there were fewer people and the service on the mountain was better. And I'm not trying to be the anti-Whistler tourism board because it's a beautiful place and it will always be beautiful, but that doesn't have anything to do with what's going on and on the, you know, on the hill or in the village. It's a tourist trap.
When was peak Whistler for you?
The 90s, mid 90s, you know, I bought my first camera in 91. So that was the last time that I started, that I had to hold down like a wage job. So from like 91 on, and it just got better and better. 98 season had the most snow in history. So I went up, I snowboarded on Tuesday and there was 30 centimeters overnight. So it was, you know, one of the best days of the season. One of the few good days we've had this season that isn't on a weekend. So I played hooky and I went up with Warburton, and we got there at 7 for an 8:30 opening, waited 90 minutes. And by the time we got to the top of the mountain, all the runs were tracked out. And I don't know how that happens, because of First Tracks breakfast, I guess, or there weren't that many people ahead of us, but there's not enough snowpack. So one of the problems this year is that we don't have a lot of snowpack. So there's nobody going in the trees. So everybody is literally on the runs. Everybody is on the exact same run. So we're, you know, it can't compete. It just can't compete. They're really good at getting the Alpine open now, it seems like. They got the Alpine open that day with 30 centimeters of new. Maybe that wouldn't have happened in the mid-90s. But, you know, on a Tuesday in the 90s with 30 centimeters of snow, you got fresh tracks all day and the next day and the next day. You know, it was just, there weren't that many people here. It's just a, you know, it's strictly a function of the amount of people on the track, on the runs. And there are faster chairs that seat more people, so you can cycle those people more quickly, more people more quickly. But that's not an improvement, you know? I know that people think it is, but it's not. Actually, I think the only people who think that it's an improvement are the resorts, because they can market it as like a six up and blah, blah, blah. But it isn't decreasing the lines. It's just putting more people on the runs.
Yeah, we just got our first six up at Meadows. And it's like, it took him until 2 p.m. the other day to get it moving. We're like, what is going on? Everyone's waiting in line. We're like, man, like that four pack was so nice. Like they're able to get it at least open by 10. And like here we are, it's 2 p.m. and they can't even get, like they got 2 feet of snow on the mountain. I know it was like a lot, but I was like, this is crazy.
I don't know if the machines are, the lifts are more complicated, mechanically complicated, but there seems like they're down way more often. So there is a nice amount of people, that there's enough people to make something awesome, but not too many to make it crowded. And that was the 90s for sure.
Yeah. Time to start split boarding and getting back into snowmobile. Yes. Whistler these days is you got better snowmobiles. And I was like, the problem with that is everybody's got better snowmobiles. Now everybody's going out.
Yeah. We started doing snowboarding in the backcountry on sleds in 95 and 96. And we had seasons where we would come across, you know, a couple of people a year. You know, there was nobody back there. So yeah, that by the time I stopped doing that, it was already too crowded for me. All of the places that are easy to go get done really quickly, but even the kind of like obscure spots get skied out. So bizarre.
You still have a snowmobile?
No, my last one got stolen and I decided not to replace it.
Nice. Yeah. I'm like waiting for mine to get stolen.
It's such a love hate. Yeah, get your insurance. It's such a love hate thing with sleds, though. You know, it's like it facilitated so many good times, but they're loud and stinky, and my hearing's probably worse than it used to be because I had a stinger, and you know.
Yeah, mine hasn't been used in the last year and a half. Tried to use it last year, and like the spark plug had gone out on it, made a mile down the trail, and it's like a 2017. I'm like, here we go. I'm going to go snowmobiling. And I'm getting towed out by my friends. I'm like, oh, God. I was like, maybe it's the hero of this thing.
That's one of the things that I think that it's real common between the kind of snowboarding and fishing we do versus some people. You know, some people are happy to just go to the resort, or they're happy to go to a put and take lake or something. But the kind of snowboarding I did was never complacent. We did a lot of searching, a lot of exploration, went to places for the first time. People had never been there. And in fishing, I can't say that I did that the same amount, but I had the same kind of idea. And I never really grabbed somebody and said, hey, show me. I always went out and said, I'm going to find it, you know? So even if people had been to runs for years, it was new to me and nobody taught me that. So it was a discovery. And that feeling of discovery is really special.
It is. I think that's why I'm liking the duck hunting a lot, because I'm not asking for handouts at all. I'm like, literally, I'm doing it. I've got one of my best friends in Bend, and we started getting into fly fishing at the same time. And we got brought out with another mutual friend last year, like the last week of duck season. And we both like went out and did it. I think we both shot one duck. We both missed probably like 20. And we're like, man, like that was so fun. Like we got to figure out how to do that without our other friends so we can like, and so we're like calling each other, like trying to go, he's over in Bend. So he's a couple hours away and like, he's trying to pick apart all like the public land that you can go and hunt there. And I'm doing the same thing here. And we're just kind of doing it together, but like also separate, like we're both doing it on our own and trying to combine our knowledge together. And I'm like, man, like this is so fun. Like I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm going to go here. I don't even know if I can go hunting here. I got my Onyx. I'm like,
yeah, that's the best.
Hopefully there's birds. Yeah. So it's, I think it's like that discovery and yeah.
And every once in a while you have one of those like turn a corner, see a thing and you're shocked to your core because it's so incredible. And if you're with a guide or, you know, there's something, it's not as pure, you know, there's something really pure about having that experience by yourself or with a friend and discovering it.
Yeah. It's like when you're going fly fishing on a brand new river and literally have to keep going because you don't know what's around the next corner. I think that's like the best thing to find in a passion is like drive to just keep going and exploring, whether it's hunting or photography.
I have a fishing buddy and he was like, hey, let's go fish this lake. There's a river connecting it to another lake. And I think we can find a way to float like from one to the other. And he's like, I know the lake's got good fish. I don't know what's in the river. I think there's a waterfall up there, blah, blah, blah. So we spent a few days and that exploration was one of my favorite things ever. We skidded down this cliff onto this tiny little creek with beautiful little pocket water and started chucking dries and every single cast of trout came. And as we walked up, there's this giant, beautiful, like cinematic waterfall. And it was like, that's a moment that, you know, that's with me forever. That kind of sense of discovery and perfect fishing and with a friend and nobody said, hey, this is where to go. It's like we took a risk. We didn't know where the trail was. The trail was very not obvious.
That's awesome.
Oh, I miss fishing buddies. I used to have more fishing buddies.
Gosh, I feel like I used to have more snowboarding buddies. Now all my snowboarding buddies are still trying to be professional snowboarders. And I'm going out with Andy Wright.
Oh, but Andy Wright was a professional snowboarder. He's a hell of a snowboarder.
Yeah, totally.
I shot photos of him when he rode for Nitro.
Really? Sick.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's me. Our little crew is me, Andy Wright, Eric Pollard, and my girlfriend, Eric's wife. And yeah, that's who we ride with every day.
It's perfect. But, you know, like having consistent people that you do anything with is almost more important than the quality of what they can do. Like, I don't care if somebody's a hack as long as they're keen. I mean, snowboarding's a little different because if they can't keep up, then forget it. But, or I guess if I went fishing with somebody and they were casting over my line, it would be the same. but having somebody who like calls you up and says, let's go, like that's it, you know?
Yeah, totally. It's fun. And I don't know if you guys have ever been to Mount Hood, but Meadows is probably, I'd say less than a quarter of the size of Whistler.
Yeah. I shot Meadows in 94.
It's pretty small, but it's like, but it's big enough that if you know where to go and you're with like the right people that can like shred it, God, on a good powder day, like you can learn how to pick it apart and get fresh runs all day. And that's been fun, like getting back to my roots at Mount Hood Meadows that I completely lost track of when I was like shooting snowboarding all the time. And it was cool after Trans World went under, I'm like, at Meadows and I'm like, man, like this, I can't even remember where to go anymore. And so the last couple of years, it's like rediscovering like where to go. And it's been super fun.
When I was in the city, the local mountains were kind of like that. Cypress has got some runs on it that, you know, on a perfect day, it feels like world-class. It's just that the perfect days are fewer and fewer these days.
So, you know, you guys, you're out there taking photos of, you know, literally the best snowboarders in the world, trying to time it so you're on some of the best days of the year. And there you are with your camera. You're not really snowboarding. I mean, if you're snowboarding, you got a pack on to get to your spot. How mentally, how much of a challenge was it to forego these opportunities yourself of being able to, you know, to ride in these conditions? The question is, And there's a commonality here with guiding. So, you know, you're out there, you're taking the photos. These guys are in the 2.5-3 feet of fresh snow having the fun. Mentally, how easy is it to miss out on this stuff for you?
I think that there's, you kind of have a trade-off where you start to, first of all, when you're in small groups like that, it's real, it's a team effort, you know? And so you, their wins are your wins too. So on one hand, you know, if it's somebody turning down a big face, then you're like, holy crap, I wish I could have done that. But if somebody's doing a switchback side nine, I wasn't doing that anyways. But, you know, my participation in that and my documenting of that is the only reason he's doing that, because he's not doing that for fun. He's doing that for his sponsors and for his career. When it gets to a certain level, the whole team works as one. And so their wins are my wins. So I don't feel FOMO about not doing it. The Alaska is a different story when you're going down faces and people are riding stuff that I can ride. And I'm like, hey, I want to do that. And every once in a while, we were in Skagway with Standard Films, and I was shooting with Slaznik and Kevin Jones and Johan. And we were doing a free run, and we went to a peak that nobody had ridden. And I'm standing there with Johan, and I'm like, all right, man, go ahead. And he's like, nah, man, I get all the first descents. This one's for you. And then I went and did a first descent in Alaska with the best snowboarder in the world. And that's enough for the rest of time. that kills your FOMO completely when you get those moments.
Yeah, I would say I'm like easily satisfied. So when I go up and like we're doing a jump day or some sort of backcountry day, if I can just get my one run, if it's like good conditions and we're building a jump all day, like all day to maybe shoot for like 30 minutes, I make it a point to try to at least get one free run in. And Curtis is usually really good about making sure that I get my run in. I'm like, dude, everything, my photos are going to be better. I'm going to be in a better mood. Just need one run. And he'll rip me up to the top of the mountain and I'll get my run in. And I'm like, that's all I needed.
That's why heli days and cat days are good, because I have a board with me. On sled days, I would never even take a board. So if there was nobody who was goofy that had a stance that I could kind of ride, because like you can borrow a board if the, you know.
You're goofy too?
Yeah. Goofy, Nikon, nice. Bridge and Light, or Bridge and Photoshop.
Yeah.
We're the same person. It's just like 10 years apart.
Yeah.
So for our listeners, you guys you've met before or never met before?
Never met.
Never met. This is our first time meeting.
No kidding. That's crazy. Wow. I'm glad I got to know you. And this is a neat opportunity for all of us to talk together. I do have a few more questions if you guys are keen to keep going for a little bit.
Sure.
Right on. So once again, that last thing we talked about, this idea of, you know, as a professional photographer, documenting people having all this fun, whether it's on the river or on the mountains, and yourself, you know, getting your one run in or recognizing that you're part of a team, so something bigger. This is exactly the same as being a good fishing guide. A bad fishing guide grabs his rod and jumps in the water and starts fishing. That's not a good fishing guide. A good fishing guide, he brings a rod in case the client needs to borrow his or hers, but it's not about his fishing. They're fishing through the client. And you can tell right away if someone's going to be a good fishing guide, if they can take their own personal desire of not missing out and set that aside and be happy to fish through the person. It's almost the highest level of fishing, because at the risk of sounding a little bit conceited, generally speaking, the clients aren't going to fish as good as I would, right? So they're not casting as well. They're not presenting the fly as well, but I can affect them by putting some effort in. And then when they have success, that's our success. And I imagine for you guys as photographers, when you get that great shot and the person jumped just the way you wanted them to, even if you couldn't do it yourself, Dano, it's got to feel fantastic, isn't it? And if you get it on the cover of a magazine, well, hey, there you go.
Yeah.
I think that was one of the things that kind of led me away from shooting snowboarding full-time, aside from the industry changing so much and it becoming very difficult to make a living. But as print failed, part of the full circle of photography includes printing, you know? And as print magazines went away, that the satisfaction of seeing the work that you've done with your friends recognized went away. And that's, you know, it's a sad loss, I'd say.
So here's a question. And maybe it's a silly question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. And it's to both of you. You can hopefully each have an answer for me. Dana, what's your favorite snowboard photo you've ever taken? Darcy, same question to you.
It changes. There's a couple that stand out, and I have to be really careful because sometimes the validation of other people affects how I feel about my own images. And so, you know, when people, there are certain images that I have that I've sold prints of a lot, and people continue to come back to the same images. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's my favorite photo, but it's also something that, you know, it probably strikes a series of memories for me. But some of them I worked really hard for, and I think they turned out really well. And I really like the person and the place. And so there's a photo, there's three that kind of stand out in my mind, and two of them are of Lucas Huffman, if you can believe that. And one of them is just, we were talking about Perfect Jump before. I was shooting Perfect Jump and I'd shot every angle, and I noticed that the shadow was coming across the foreground, and I got into a place where I could get the shadow, his shadow in the foreground, and it super enlarged because of the nature of the shadow coming off the sun and being closer to me. And it was pretty iconic, and I've seen 100 photographers copy it since. And so there's like, that feels good, that it's flattering when people see a shot and they try and make their version of it. That's pretty cool. Craig Kelly, because he's Craig Kelly, and because we had a day and I watched him ride a line. It was not a difficult photo to take. I stood there and I clicked the shutter, but he's tracing a line down the mountain, and you can see how he rides by looking at his line and where he is on the face. And it's going to be, I think it's going to be in the new Eric Blem book about Craig Kelly coming out this fall or this spring. But the one that I worked hard for and that I like a lot and it stands out, it was almost night. It was close to Revelstoke. It was a road gap with Lucas, and it was very, very deep. And I set up a strobe. And in those days, the remote strobes were not very reliable. And I managed to get like a little piece of light in the middle of darkness, lighting up a perfect style Lucas Huffman jumping over this road. And it stands out as one that I really love it. It's very minimal and very simple. It's not like a very layered, complicated picture, but I worked hard for it. I love the guy. I love the place. I love the trip that I was on. And it was a difficult, difficult photo to make.
Is it a pretty blue photo?
Yep.
I think I know the photo that you're talking about. It's epic.
Yeah.
Or at least there's one that you shot with it looks like it's strobe, and it's just got a super blue sort of feel to it, kind of cold. And it's like, I think it's an epic.
I set up the strobe and it wasn't powerful enough as when it was full light, but we were getting late in the day. And as it got darker, the strobe becomes more powerful against the ambient light. So it managed to freeze the action. So the first images were blurry and then they became sharp, tack sharp.
I wanted to mention, Dano, that photo of Craig Kelly is actually my favorite photo I've ever seen of yours. And what I love about it is you talked about storytelling. To me, that photo tells a story, and that story is entirely in his line, his route to the mountain, how he played with the edge there. Yeah, it's a great shot.
Yeah. And people, when we discuss that photo, lots of times people will be like, I would have gone down here. So they place themselves in the image as well. So it becomes, a bigger story. And I love that.
This is, I don't know if you can see that.
That's it.
Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that I was trying to describe. That's on all time. One of the coolest photos. Yeah, so sick.
Sunpak 120J, like just a bare bulb flash.
That's perfect. Yeah.
Like 4 AA battery flash.
Yeah. Well, I guess I got a couple favorites, but I think the one that comes to mind is this photo of Kazu that I shot on Mount Hood. And I think it's one of my favorite photos for a couple of reasons. I think it was so cool that like somebody like Kazu would come basically to Oregon to shoot with me and to be on Mount Hood and like do one of the Mount Hood jumps. And like, we went to this area, you gotta go all the way to the very top of Palmer, and then you like traverse out to this area called Paradise Park, and it's just crazy wind lips everywhere, and it felt like it's a little different every year. And like, we're looking at this one big, I guess, wind lip, you would call it. I guess I'll just have to show you the photo somehow, but we ended up building a quarter pipe on it, and we worked on it all day, and we're like, all right, well, let's just go. We'll come back and shoot it tomorrow. Like, we've already done enough work. And it was like me, Kazu, his friends. We had Helgeson out there and like Kevin Backstrom and like that whole crew was also out there helping us. And Kazi was like, well, let me just try to hit it once. And he goes up and he does like a little error and he falls. And the sun is about to go behind like the horizon. And he's like, I'm going to go one more time, one more. And he goes up and we're literally like on the brink of not having any sun. It's like sunset. And I'm like, let's just like, he didn't go very big last time, but like Kazi goes huge. So I'm like, all right, let's make sure I zoom out enough in case he goes like some biblical height. And he does like one of the most insane back 180 Japans I've ever seen done. And it's like, and everything about the photo is perfect. There's no strobes. It's completely organic. Like, and like Dana, like I used to just try to light up everything. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to bring my strobes out. Like we get to shoot this evening. It's going to be just all natural light. So he does this, he stomps it, he rides out and he looks, takes one look at the photo and he's like, I'm done. I don't need to hit it anymore. He never hit it again after that. All the whole next day, he just watched the whole session. I sent it to Hamilton at Transworld, the photo, and literally Nick was like, yeah, that's it. That's one of the last covers of Transworld right there. And it was the second last cover of Transworld, which was awesome.
So one with the Sea of Clouds?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that photo.
Yeah. Everything about that, like the trust that Kazu had in me like to make that whole sort of trip happen, and we ended up getting that photo. It's just so, so crazy. Like when we spent all day trying to make a jump and he literally hits it 1.5 times basically. And like, that was all I needed. He was like, that was the shot I needed. I'm done. The crew hit it all the next day too. And we hit it into sunset the next day. Couldn't top that photo. I think like, just like the landing was so raw and like everything about it was just like, and the Sea of Clouds was so cool. There's another photo I shot in Whistler of Rasmin. I think it's Man Boy Gap. I think that's what they call it. It's like a really sick jump. And it was just, I don't think everybody really would consider it like one of their favorite photos of mine. But like when I see it, I was like, it's a black and white photo. It's Rasmin's doing like a back seven over the gap, which is like one of the coolest tricks you can photograph. And the light was coming in like so crazy that I was making like perfect layers throughout the whole frame of the photo. And like compositionally, it's like perfect and beautiful. I'm like, every time I see it, it makes me feel good. So that's one of my other favorite photos.
Okay, so then the follow-up question to that is, what's your favorite fishing photo?
That's a good question, Brian. And I know I have like, you know what? I got one. There's this photo I shot at Steamboat Creek, which is a tributary of the North Umpqua. And it's this basically, the whole creek runs way too warm. And there's this one little feeder creek that flows into it that puts cold water out. And hundreds of steelhead will just hang out right in this one little area. And there, it's called the Big Bend Pool or Dynamite Hole. People used to throw sticks of dynamite and blow up all the fish like back in the day there. It's horrible. But there's this guy, Lee Spencer, I think is his name. And he kind of like, he's an old timer now, but he just kind of guards over the fish and like you can go down and like just sit there with him and like watch the fish. I took this one picture of the fish, one of them just like coming out and like just breaking the surface. You can see all the fish down underneath and this one just has its back out and it's like a perfect like, what's it called? The golden ratio? What's golden composition? Do you know what I'm talking about, Dana? Where your eye just kind of keeps around in circles.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of like one of those photos. It's like super green and yeah, it's very simple, but it's one of my favorite fishing photos. It's not, doesn't even have anything to do with fly fishing. It's literally just watching fish.
That's awesome. And you know, that really goes with what you were saying before about like the story. And I say this to people all the time when they're like, what's the deal with fishing? Because I have a lot of non-fishing friends. I'm like, I don't care if I catch a fish. I will walk along a river and there will be white noise in my ears and I will see things and my brain will stretch out and I'm not looking at a phone. And catching a fish is, luckily, it's really low on my list of priorities because I'm actually kind of a shitty fisherman. But the experience of it is really, really important to me. And the actual catching is not that much. I never made fishing photography a thing, but I did shoot fishing quite a bit. And every time I've gone out to shoot, I've gotten something that just like really resonates. And because I didn't have to sell it, there's a real privilege in not having to sell your photos as a professional photographer, because you can take chances and do whatever you want. But, you know, to me, those moments are memories, like with people. And I had a day out with you, Brian, in Squamish, and your client. I just went out with a camera. I didn't have a rod and shot. And I don't remember who your client was, but he was hell of a caster. And it was like a super cold, frosty day. And there's a shot where he's just on his cast, and the fly's coming out of the water, and you can see it's pink and it's, you know, trailing. As much as I love that photo, it's that day. And I had a day with Mike Blankharn where he took his jet boat up the Squamish, and he was kind of a hero to me. So I was just like, all right, I'm going to go fish with Mike. So I brought a camera, and I didn't catch anything, and I didn't fish very well, but I have a photo of him that you can't tell it's him. It's purposely out of focus. So it's just this, like all the lit up light of the water that are all blobs, and he's a blob in the middle of it. And it's an abstract, and it's almost emotional to me when I look at it, you know? And that's the kind of thing that good photography does. It takes you to a place, and it can evoke something that's more than just, this is a thing that AI is never going to do. It just can't. It just can't, because it's inherently fake, you know? But like, I'll sit here with misty eyes thinking about the best, all these amazing times. And sometimes it's an interesting thing, because I always said I would never shoot weddings because, what a horrible thing to have to do. But then one of my best friends asked me to shoot his wedding. And I was like, you know, it's the least I could do. And I shot it, and I thought I did a really good job. And then I thought about his wedding, and I didn't feel like I was there. And it was like, what a tragedy to not be at your friend's thing. And that's kind of the case with the camera a lot of times. I'm in a very specific space that has nothing to do with what's going on. I'm really concerned with making sure that all the things that I need to happen to make a great picture are happening, and not so much with it's a pretty kind of a selfish place. And I'm not involved in the thing in front of me that much. You know, when you were talking before, Brian, like, do you feel like you miss out when you're in those things? Not really. I'm so focused. Like, my brain works really hard when I'm taking photos. I sweat like crazy when I'm taking photos. There's like a lot going on. It's intellectually and emotionally intense thing, which seems stupid because you're just picking up a box and clicking a button, but there's a lot involved in it.
I agree. I absolutely agree with that. I feel like my girlfriend like has given up trying to have conversations with me when I'm in photo mode. I'm like, nah,
for sure.
I'm in my realm right now. I got to just be here.
When I was living in the city, I spent quite a bit of time shooting street photography as an exercise, because it's very, very difficult. It's one of the more difficult things to shoot. And for a long time, when we would walk the dog or whatever, I'd bring a camera thinking, oh, well, we're just walking the dog. I'm on the street. I'll take a camera and I can shoot. And it just doesn't work that way. You know, you cannot split your focus and be with somebody and talk to them and make sure the dog doesn't run away and take pictures. They're just not the same thing, you know?
Yeah, I live in the camera. When I'm shooting photos, I'm in it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. It's such a privilege to be able to have that mindset.
Yeah, I like it.
And you know, the biggest compliment that I ever got was from a client when I was working with Magpul, and their in-house photographer was looking at my stuff, and he was like, God, you just see the world different. And I was like, and I don't know if he was actually complimenting me. He might have been talking shit about my photos, but I took it as a huge compliment, like the absolute best.
Where do you guys see fishing photography going from here? And what I mean by that, and I think it's had a positive influence in the sense that it's held people a little bit more accountable, but I think it's also had a negative impact where sometimes getting the photo of the fish trumps being in the moment, as we kind of talked a little bit about before. So what we've seen on the good side of this is, of course, you know, the advancement of fish handling, the whole idea of keep them wet, to the point where if someone presents a photo on Instagram or other social media platform and the fish is out of the water, 9 times out of 10, someone's going to jump all over them and be like, hey, put that fish in the water. What are you doing? So because of that, I think it's had an influence on the younger generation of angler in particular, who is really these days generally pretty good about keeping fish in the water. Ironically, some of the older anglers, people older than us, who were, you know, early generations of steelheaders who maybe pulled their fish up onto the beach and laid a rod next to it and took a photo, you know, people just don't tolerate that anymore. But back then that was sort of seen as artistic. Where do you guys see fishing photography going from here?
Well, I think like what I'm doing with Sims, it's a lot of times it is the storytelling now. So it's like less about the fish, more about like the moment. And when fish are involved, it's all fish dependent. So it's like, are you going to eat that fish? Is that fish going to be something that you can be like holding up out of the water and like whatever? But like, if it's something that's going to be a released fish, the primary focus when I'm taking any sort of fishing photo is if that fish is going to be released, we're going to get the photos and do everything we can to release that fish when it wants to be released. So like, we're not trying to hold on to it for an unnecessary amount of time or mess with it. What I can photograph in that moment, which sometimes could only last seconds, that's what we're going to get. And I think that's really important for like fish handling, is that, is it a dinner fish or is it going to be something that we want to live on? And as soon as you make that connection, like, you take that fish and you treat it with whatever respect you can give it, so that it can have its best shot at swimming away. And the photo is not important. The story is important. The photo of the fish isn't nearly as important. So
I think it's very difficult for people to give up the clutch photo. You know, it's their trophy on the wall to show that they did a thing. And luckily, I think that the trends are towards better fish handling. And one of the things with the advance of cameras is that there's less chance of people screwing up the photo, so having to hold the fish longer. And so, you know, people can quickly and effectively get the picture that they want the first time without having to screw around. I think there'll be a time when lots of people will forgo the clutch shot entirely. Maybe just get a, you know, the release, the natural release in the process. To me, it's way more interesting to see somebody's whole process of actually getting in the net, out the net, without actually holding it up. Why? You know, like that's a false moment. The real moment is how they actually go through that process. So as a documentarian, which I essentially am, I want to see that more than I want to see them holding the fish up. But the best that we can do to put the least amount of stress on, you know, this dwindling resource or potentially dwindling resource, it's really important to do that. But no one's ever going to stop clutching a fish, and there's always going to be somebody who does it in a way that other people think is wrong.
And I mean, you work really hard to catch that fish sometimes. It's nice to have that memory, so I get it.
Sure.
And it is really nice, like you were saying, like iPhones, like I'll like be holding a fish and somebody will be like, all right, I got it. I'm like, I just got it in my hands. They're like, yeah, I took 30 photos already. I'm like, oh God, okay, cool. Awesome.
Yeah. What a great feeling to know that it's gotten and before you even had to think about it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I don't know if you want to jump into that question, Brian, about just kind of tips about shooting fish photos. But I guess like one of the things that I would say, like, if you're new to it and you just want like a sort of a tip to try to get that really nice photo of a fish, is you don't need to make eye contact with the camera. Like, you're holding the fish, you have them in the water, like, be with the fish. Like, you don't need to be like, as soon as you start looking at the camera, it takes focus off that fish and puts it on yourself. So like, I always tell people to just like look at the fish. And the other big thing, which is hard, and like obviously it's not always possible, especially if you're trying to handle the fish really well, but watch your shadow if it's sunny out. Like, there's so many times, and I'll do the same thing. I'll like be like, all right, I'm going to take this picture. And I'm like, and there's my whole shadow just blocking all the fish right now. So like, just be aware of that. Like, and like what Dana was saying was like, think about the photo, like light being part of the photo. Like, if you're blocking the light, turns out you're going to be able to see that in that final photo. But so, yeah, so having whoever's holding the fish be engaged with the fish and just minding where the light's coming from. And minimizing how much stress is on that fish. And when it's ready to go, that was your photo opportunity. It's photo opportunity is done, fish is gone.
And if you're shooting those photos, after the fish is gone, take a picture of that person's face, because man, that's the moment when they just realize what just happened.
Yeah, I've got this this picture of Lael, and this guy Lael Johnson, he's a guide in Washington, and he had just released a fish, and he's literally just taking the net and he's just smelling the net. I have a picture of that. And I'm like, that is an awesome photo.
Amazing.
And that tells the story better than the actual fish in the photo. So
that's the uniqueness of that will stand out over a clutching photo every day of the week. You know, people will always remember somebody smelling a net.
Yeah.
That's the key to great photography, though, is something that's surprising or unique and that brings you something that you're not expecting or that you've never seen before.
So, Dano, what do you think? What can you share with people that might help them take better photos when they're on the river themselves?
I think that the biggest fail I had in my early career was focusing on the action. And I think that the story is way more than that. So, you know, take a look around and take more pictures of things that aren't just a guy casting or a fish. You know, that's the things that you'll remember are the light through the trees. You know, the things you'll remember is how that group of leaves is swirling around in the pool. The things that you'll remember is like just a piece of water that just looks so juicy. And, you know, fishermen know that feeling when you look at something, you're like, God, that's fishy. You know, that you can photograph that. You don't have to keep that one to yourself. Those are great memories. Take more pictures than just the fishing.
Yeah, totally. It's like that epic fish photo is like that Kazu cover photo. It is like the backbone of the moment. But there's so much that goes into either side of that, like the smelling the net or the sun coming through the trees and stuff. Like, I think that's like the big thing. And I think just like you, Dano, I did the same thing. Like, I was so obsessed when I was starting my photographic career to get like the coolest snowboarding photo that I would forget about all the moments in between. And I think the same thing can get lost in fishing, and you're just trying to get you just want that awesome brown 30-inch brown trout photo lifted 5 feet out of the water. No, you want all the moments in between that. And I think that's what the direction that I see fishing photography going to. So that's good. There's only so many fish that can get caught and be photographed. But there's endless adventures.
You know, when you're driving along in a place that you haven't been before and you see a some sort of fish sticker on a sign and you're like, oh, they're here. You know, like take that picture. That's a really interesting picture. In the fall, after our salmon runs are all done and it gets cold, there's always like little jawbones of chum all over the place with their little dog teeth. And one day I took a picture of one that was just completely covered in rime frost. And that's like the fishiest photo I've ever taken. You know, it has nothing to do with actually fishing. It's just that moment where fishermen are walking along and they see that and they're like, oh, that's a thing that speaks to me, you know, so other stuff.
I think storytelling is a common theme in our discussion. It wasn't anything we planned on, but it's just kind of the way it's gone. And I think you're right. A great photo will evoke some type of emotion. So when you said that, Dano, I could picture that because I've been out on the river at that time of year and I've seen those jawbones looking like that. And now it reminds me of what it feels like to be, you know, seeing your breath and the cold air at that time of year. And it takes you back. So guys, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Before I let you go, and hopefully we'll do this again. And certainly Darcy, I've got to get all over Ejack here to come and do a talk with me about alignment.
Yeah, and Curtis, let's get the three amigos in that one.
Yeah, I think that would be special. And Dano, would love to have you back sometime too. Hopefully this in the bucket thing is something that keeps going for years and years for us. So if folks want to connect with either of you guys, Dano, do you have a website? Do you have an Instagram these days? How do people find you?
Yeah, I don't post very much on Instagram. It's every once in a while I'll throw up an old snowboarding photo. It's Dano Pendergrass, all one word. I'm not that much on social media, but you can find images at danopendergrass.com. Since I became a real job haver, I feel kind of fortunate. Part of the thing about social media is that it's an obligation when you're a freelancer. You have to, you know, promote yourself. And I was early to that train and I really, really burnt out on it. So I'm happy to not do nearly as much of it anymore. But I'll put some stories in the Instagram stories when cool things are happening.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. Baca Photo is my Instagram account and I don't post on it all that often, but when I'm on trips and stuff, I like to add to the stories and whatnot. And every once in a while, I'll throw out some nice new photos. So that's definitely a good way to follow me. And I've got a website also, baca.photo. I think it's still working. It's been a little while since I updated it, but it's a good way to like check out some of my photography. But I think like anything current just gets thrown up on Instagram. That's probably about 2% of all the photography. So much of my photography just ends up on client hard drives and never gets to see the light of day.
Oh, it's tragic. Tragic.
It really is. It's kind of just the world we live in. But doing better about using all my photos because I get on them.
It's an argument for having a print show. And, you know, one of the great things about the Ski and Snowboard Fest back in the day and the Pro Photo Showdown was it was this chance to see all of these photographers' best work. And, you know, we don't have that same kind of outlet anymore. But, Brian, maybe you should just have like a gallery show in Terrace once a year.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you guys probably have heard of Cast and Blast. That was an event we used to do in Squamish. And certainly there was a slideshow component and a filmmaker component to that. And to be honest, I modeled the thing in a lot of ways after Ski and Snowboard Fest because I'd seen that be successful in Whistler. And I thought that something similar was missing in the fishing space. But with all that being said, for me personally, you're right. It's when you're on the river fishing, it's nice to not have your phone with you. And for me personally, the fishing experiences that I recall the most usually aren't fish I've landed. It's fish I've lost. That's certainly one. But it's sometimes, like you guys said earlier, it's the people you're with. And a frequent fishing partner, that's a real neat relationship because so much of the day you're within sight of each other, but you're not communicating. And certainly pre-cell phone, you know, you just, you know, he's over there, you're over here. That's just the way it is. And I imagine, Darcy, with your new passion of duck hunting, it's got to be something similar too, because you guys are laying low and not trying to yell at each other.
Yeah, exactly. And then sometimes it's all about just being by yourself and like being in the moment. So it's either being with your buddy and just hanging out in the blind, just making small talk, chit chatting, or just hanging out by yourself. And it's the same with fly fishing. Like I like being with my buddy or my girlfriend, or I like just being by myself sometimes.
Right on. Well, guys, I hope we get a chance to get out on the river together at some point this coming year. You're both always welcome up here in Terrace. We'd love to have you. And I really want to thank you again for joining me today and look forward to having another discussion sometime soon.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Brian.
Thanks for making this happen. It was great to talk to you, Darcy.
Yeah, you as well. We'll stay in touch about a photo workshop.
That sounds amazing.
Well, that's the show for today. And once again, I want to thank Darcy and Dano for joining me and speaking about fishing, photography, and some old snowboarding stories. I've really enjoyed speaking with you guys and hope we get to do it again soon. To the listener, really appreciate you tuning in, and I hope you'll join us next month when I'll be speaking with Stu Foxall, Eric Leininger, and Scoot Mason. We're going to talk fly design and a variety of different fisheries. These guys are great anglers, and I know you're not going to want to miss this episode. Until then, hope you get out on the water, and I look forward to seeing you next time on In the Bucket.
Hey, fish fans, it's Brian Niska here. Just want to remind you that you can find all episodes of In the Bucket online at inthebucketpodcast.com. Our website includes a page of notes for each of our shows with information on our guests and interesting photos, videos, and links for the topics we discuss each month. You can also find us on Instagram at In the Bucket Podcast. Thanks again for listening. I look forward to bringing you the next show.